What does it feel like to stand on the right side of history? In November 1989, a young Oxford student raced toward Berlin with thousands of others, champagne in hand, chipping away at concrete that had divided a continent. The Cold War was ending. Liberal democracy had won. The future felt limitless. Fast forward 3 decades, that same person found himself in Moscow after Trump's election, attending a conference celebrating the polycentric world order, diplomatic code for a post-American world. While we danced on Berlin's rubble, Vladimir Putin watched his world crumble from his KGB office in Dresden. Now he was celebrating. Something had gone terribly wrong with the story we told ourselves about progress, democracy, and the inevitable march of history. We're living through history's most dramatic economic transformation. Half of Western populations experienced zero income growth for an entire generation. While global poverty plummeted below 10%, wages in Ohio and Manchester stagnated for 30 years. China lifted 700 million people from poverty in 4 decades. Cities like Shenzhen transformed from fishing villages to tech hubs faster than most people change careers. Economists promised mutual gains from trade. What actually happened? Middle-skill jobs vanished, manufacturing moved to Asia, and automation eliminated clerical work. What remained was a barbell economy: high-paying jobs for the educated elite, low-wage service work for everyone else, and a hollowed-out middle. The Davos crowd responded with buzzwords while corporate profits soared and wages flatlined. When the WTO overruled European objections to genetically modified foods, the message became clear. Unelected international bodies now override democratic decisions. Economist Donny Roderick identified the impossible trinity. We cannot simultaneously have democracy, national sovereignty, and economic globalization. One must give way. For decades, we sacrificed national sovereignty. Now, democracy itself teeters on the edge. Democracy expanded dramatically in the late 20th century, from 30 democracies to over 100 by 2000. Leaders like Clinton, Blair, and Schroeder celebrated a third way, speaking fluent McKinsey-speak at Davos. This worked until 2008, when the financial crisis revealed how many had been abandoned. Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign exemplified this disconnect. Her slogan, "Stronger Together," meant nothing. Her policies, like offering precisely $17,500 in loan forgiveness for startup founders in distressed communities, represented technocracy's exhaustion. Her "basket of deplorables" comment spoke volumes. Most alarming isn't populism's rise, but elite disillusionment with democracy itself. While 75% of Americans born before World War II rate democracy's importance at 10 out of 10, barely 30% of millennials agree. Among wealthy Americans, support for authoritarian alternatives jumped from 5% in 1995 to 17% by 2014. When a prominent New York financier suggested a knowledge test for voting, he revealed what many elites privately believe: maybe not everyone should vote. Didier Erabon's memoir captures a transformation repeated across the West. In Reims, France, his factory worker father and cleaner mother were militant communists who saw the world divided cleanly, those for workers and those against. When Erabon returned after his father's death, his mother still cleaned houses, but now voted for Marine Le Pen's National Front. "Right or left, there's no difference," she said. "The same people always end up footing the bill." The working class hadn't vanished. They'd transferred loyalty from class-based politics to nationalist identity. The populist right stole the left's clothes, defending the welfare state while restricting it to nationals. This welfare chauvinism proved potent. The more generous the welfare system, the more bitter the reaction against immigrants. UKIP transformed from an anti-tax party to an NHS defender. Trump became the first Republican nominee to promise increased Social Security and Medicare spending, declaring, "I love the poorly educated." Meanwhile, leftist intellectuals replaced working class with left behind, no longer romanticized but denigrated. Trump's WWE appearance at WrestleMania 23, where he shaved CEO Vince McMahon's head before 80,000 fans, was political training. The McMahons later donated $5 million to Trump's foundation, and Linda McMahon joined his administration. WWE's evolution mirrors societal transformation. Cold War storylines featuring patriotic heroes battling foreign villains gave way to personal feuds revolving around personal pain, vendettas, and fantasies of revenge. Ultimate Fighting Championship, with its unscripted violence and real blood, now surpasses WWE in popularity. This echoes Huxley's Brave New World more than Orwell's 1984. We're too entertained to notice eroding freedoms. In 1980s East Germany, regions receiving Western TV showed less political resistance despite accessing Western news. Viewers preferred Dallas and Dynasty to democratic ideals. Today, Russians can access global news, yet most choose state-approved entertainment. As one journalist observed, most Russians are happy with the trade-off: complete freedom for complete silence. The U.S.-China relationship represents the gravest threat to global stability. When Obama visited Beijing in 2009 seeking partnership, Chinese authorities blocked media access and orchestrated his appearances. This humiliation prompted his pivot to Asia, redistributing military assets, establishing Australian bases, and strengthening regional alliances. America's persistent demands for Chinese democratization created a zero-sum dynamic neither side can escape. Western economists predicted economic development would inevitably produce democracy. They were wrong. The Chinese Communist Party adapted market principles while maintaining authoritarian control, creating a model that challenges Western assumptions about capitalism and freedom. The nuclear landscape has grown vastly more complex than during the Cold War, with four additional states now possessing nuclear weapons beyond the original five. Putin's leadership eroded strategic stability, while China's military modernization and India's nuclear development sparked an Asian arms race. Cyber warfare adds another destabilizing dimension, targeting critical infrastructure and financial systems simultaneously without clear rules of engagement. One miscalculation over Taiwan could trigger direct confrontation between nuclear-armed powers. The phrase, "that is not who we are," exposes liberalism's fatal flaw, presenting current thinking as self-evident truth while casting dissenters as moral outcasts. In the 1960s, the Western left abandoned solidarity for personal liberation. When Democrats reformed to include women, minorities, and youth, but excluded working males, blue-collar whites migrated to conservatives. Since the 1970s, governments privatized risk while work became precarious. Nearly 60% of Americans now earn hourly wages with a median of $1,561. Beyond economics, workers' greatest complaint is being treated without respect, whether in Amazon warehouses or service cubicles. When banks received bailouts while millions lost homes, ordinary people saw moral betrayal. Universal basic income severs the connection between effort and self-respect. We need bolder solutions: universal healthcare, enforced immigration laws, simplified taxation targeting carbon, not jobs, corporate taxation where business actually occurs. Technical and service jobs need greater rewards, following European vocational models. Above all, money's stranglehold on legislation must break. When Obama proposed modest taxation of carried interest, one billionaire compared it to Hitler invading Poland, yet remained silent about Trump's Muslim ban while celebrating deregulation. Ancient thinkers recognized the rich threaten republics more than the poor. Since the 1970s, liberalism's retreat is not inevitable. Reversing it requires acknowledging legitimate grievances fueling populism and restoring dignity to those left behind. We once believed we stood on history's right side. Now we know history has no sides, only choices we make when confronting uncomfortable truths.